We cannot pretend to understand what such causality inversion means. Will people at such a time be born in the grave and die in the womb? Will time flow backward? Do these questions have any meaning? Scientists wonder about what happens in an oscillating universe at the cusps, at the transition from contraction to expansion. Some think that the laws of nature are then randomly reshuffled, that the kind of physics and chemistry that orders this universe represent only one of an infinite range of possible natural laws. It is easy to see that only a very restricted range of laws of nature are consistent with galaxies and stars, planets, life, and intelligence. If the laws of nature are unpredictably reassorted at the cusps, then it is only by the most extraordinary coincidence that the cosmic slot machine has this time come up with a universe consistent with us. The laws of nature cannot be randomly reshuffled at the cusps. If the universe has already gone through many oscillations, many possible laws of gravity would have been so weak that, for any given initial expansion, the universe would not have held together. Once the universe stumbles upon such a gravitational law, it flies apart and has no further opportunity to experience another oscillation and another cusp and another set of laws of nature. Thus, we can deduce from the fact that the universe exists either a finite age or a severe restriction on the kinds of laws of nature permitted in each oscillation. If the laws of physics are not randomly reshuffled at the cusps, there must be a regularity, a set of rules that determines which laws are permissible and which are not. Such a set of rules would comprise a new physics standing over the existing physics. Our language is impoverished. There seems to be no suitable name for such a new physics. Both paraphysics and metaphysics have been preempted by other, rather different and quite possibly wholly irrelevant activities. Perhaps transphysics would do. Do we live in a universe that expands forever, or in one in which there is an infinite set of cycles? There are ways to find out, by making an accurate census of the total amount of matter in the universe, or by seeing to the edge of the cosmos. Radio telescopes can detect very faint, very distant objects. As we look deep into space, we also look far back into time. The nearest quasar is perhaps half a billion light years away. The farthest may be 10 or 12 or more billions. But if we see an object 12 billion light years away, we are seeing it as it was 12 billion years ago in time. By looking far out into space, we are also looking far back into time, back toward the horizon of the universe, back toward the epoch of the Big Bang. The Very Large Array, VLA, is a collection of 27 separate radio telescopes in a remote region of New Mexico. It is a phased array, the individual telescopes electronically connected, as if it were a single telescope of the same size as its remotest elements, as if it were a radio telescope tens of kilometers across. The VLA is able to resolve or discriminate fine detail in the radio regions of the spectrum comparable to what the largest ground-based telescopes can do in the optical region of the spectrum. Sometimes, such radio telescopes are connected with telescopes on the other side of the Earth, forming a baseline comparable to the Earth's diameter, in a certain sense, a telescope as large as the planet. In the future, we may have telescopes in the Earth's orbit, around toward the other side of the Sun, in effect, a radio telescope as large as the inner solar system. Such telescopes may reveal the internal structure and nature of quasars. Perhaps a quasar standard candle will be found, and the distances to the quasars determined independent of their red shifts. By understanding the structure and the red shift of the most distant quasars, it may be possible to see whether the expansion of the universe was faster billions of years ago, whether the expansion is slowing down, whether the universe will one day collapse. Modern radio telescopes are exquisitely sensitive. A distant quasar is so faint that its detected radiation amounts perhaps to a quadrillionth of a watt. The total amount of energy from outside the solar system ever received by all the radio telescopes on the planet Earth is less than the energy of a single snowflake striking the ground. In detecting the cosmic background radiation, in counting quasars, in searching for intelligent signals from space, radio astronomers are dealing with amounts of energy that are barely there at all. Some matter, particularly the matter in the stars, glows in visible light and is easy to see. Other matter, gas and dust in the outskirts of galaxies, for example, is not so readily detected. It does not give off visible light, although it seems to give off radio waves. This is one reason that the unlocking of the cosmological mysteries requires us to use exotic instruments and frequencies different from the visible light to which our eyes are sensitive. Observatories in Earth orbit have found an intense X-ray glow between the galaxies. It was first thought to be hot intergalactic hydrogen, an immense amount of it never before seen, perhaps enough to close the cosmos and to guarantee that we are trapped in an oscillating universe. But more recent observations by Riccardo Giacconi may have resolved the X-ray glow into individual points, perhaps an immense horde of distant quasars. They contribute previously unknown mass to the universe as well. When the cosmic inventory is completed and the mass of all the galaxies, quasars, black holes, intergalactic hydrogen, gravitational waves, and still more exotic denizens of space is summed up, we will know what kind of universe we inhabit. In discussing the large-scale structure of the cosmos, astronomers are fond of saying that space is curved, or that there is no center to the cosmos, or that the universe is finite but unbounded. Whatever are they talking about? Let us imagine we inhabit a strange country where everyone is perfectly flat. Following Edwin Abbott, a Shakespearean scholar who lived in Victorian England, we call it Flatland. Some of us are squares, some are triangles, some have more complex shapes. We scurry about in and out of our flat buildings, occupied with our flat businesses and dalliances. Everyone in Flatland has width and length, but no height whatever. We know about left, right, and forward, back, but have no hint, not a trace of comprehension about up, down, except for flat mathematicians. They say, listen, it's really very easy. Imagine left, right. Imagine forward, back. Okay so far? Now, imagine another dimension at right angles to the other two. And we say, what are you talking about? At right angles to the other two? There are only two dimensions. Point to that third dimension. Where is it? So the mathematicians, disheartened, amble off. Nobody listens to mathematicians. Every square creature in Flatland sees another square as merely a short line segment, the side of the square nearest to him. He can see the other side of the square only by taking a short walk. But the inside of a square is forever mysterious unless some terrible accident or autopsy breaches the sides and exposes the interior parts. One day, a three-dimensional creature, shaped like an apple, say, comes upon Flatland, hovering above it. Observing a particularly attractive and congenial-looking square entering its flat house, the apple decides, in a gesture of interdimensional amity, to say hello. How are you? Asks the visitor from the third dimension. I am a visitor from the third dimension. The wretched square looks about his closed house and sees no one. What is worse, to him, it appears that the greeting entering from above is emanating from his own flat body, a voice from within. A little insanity, he perhaps reminds himself gamely, runs in the family. Exasperated at being judged a psychological aberration, the apple descends into Flatland. Now, a three-dimensional creature can exist in Flatland only partially. Only a cross-section can be seen, only the points of contact with the plain surface of Flatland. An apple slithering through Flatland would appear first as a point and then as progressively larger, roughly circular slices. The square sees a point appearing in a closed room in his two-dimensional world and slowly growing into a near circle. A creature of strange and changing shape has appeared from nowhere. Rebuffed, unhappy at the obtuseness of the very flat, the apple bumps the square and sends him aloft, fluttering and spinning into that mysterious third dimension. At first, the square can make no sense of what is happening. It is utterly outside his experience. But eventually, he realizes that he is viewing Flatland from a peculiar vantage point. Above. He can see into closed rooms. He can see into his flat fellows. He is viewing his universe from a unique and devastating perspective. Traveling through another dimension provides, as an incidental benefit, a kind of X-ray vision. Eventually, like a falling leaf, our square slowly descends to the surface. From the point of view of his fellow Flatlanders, he has unaccountably disappeared from a closed room and then, distressingly, materialized from nowhere. "For heaven's sake," they say, "what's happened to you?" "I think," he finds himself replying, "I was up." They pat him on his sides and comfort him. Delusions always ran in his family. In such interdimensional contemplations, we need not be restricted to two dimensions. We can, following Abbott, imagine a world of one dimension, where everyone is a line segment, or even the magical world of zero-dimensional beasts, the points. But perhaps more interesting is the question of higher dimensions. Could there be a fourth physical dimension? If a fourth dimensional creature existed, it could, in our three-dimensional universe, appear and dematerialize at will, change shape remarkably, pluck us out of locked rooms, and make us appear from nowhere. It could also turn us inside out. There are several ways in which we can be turned inside out. The least pleasant would result in our viscera and internal organs being on the outside and the entire cosmos, glowing intergalactic gas, galaxies, planets, everything, on the inside. I am not sure I like the idea. We can imagine generating a cube in the following way. Take a line segment of a certain length and move it an equal length at right angles to itself. That makes a square. Move the square an equal length at right angles to itself, and we have a cube. We understand this cube to cast a shadow, which we usually draw as two squares with their vertices connected. If we examine the shadow of a cube in two dimensions, we notice that not all the lines appear equal and not all the angles are right angles. The three-dimensional object has not been perfectly represented in its transfiguration into two dimensions. This is the cost of losing a dimension in the geometrical projection. Now, let us take our three-dimensional cube and carry it at right angles to itself through a fourth physical dimension, not left-right, not forward-back, not up-down, but simultaneously at right angles to all those directions. I cannot show you what direction that is, but I can imagine it to exist. In such a case, we would have generated a four-dimensional hypercube, also called a tesseract. I cannot show you a tesseract, because we are trapped in three dimensions, but what I can show you is the shadow in three dimensions of a tesseract. It resembles two nested cubes, all the vertices connected by lines. But for a real tesseract in four dimensions, all the lines would be of equal length, and all the angles would be right angles. Imagine a universe just like Flatland, except that unbeknownst to its inhabitants, their two-dimensional universe is curved through a third physical dimension. When the Flatlanders take short excursions, their universe looks flat enough, but if one of them takes a long enough walk along what seems to be a perfectly straight line, he uncovers a great mystery. Although he has not reached a barrier and has never turned around, he has somehow come back to the place from which he started. His two-dimensional universe must have been warped, bent, or curved through a mysterious third dimension. He cannot imagine that third dimension, but he can deduce it. Increase all dimensions in this story by one, and you have a situation that may apply to us. Where is the center of the cosmos? Is there an edge to the universe? What lies beyond that? In a two-dimensional universe curved through a third dimension, there is no center, at least not on the surface of the sphere. The center of such a universe is not in that universe. It lies inaccessible in the third dimension inside the sphere. While there is only so much area on the surface of the sphere, there is no edge to this universe. It is finite, but unbounded. And the question of what lies beyond is meaningless. Flat creatures cannot, on their own, escape their two dimensions. Increase all dimensions by one, and you have the situation that may apply to us. The universe as a four-dimensional hypersphere, with no center and no edge and nothing beyond. Why do all the galaxies seem to be running away from us? The hypersphere is expanding from a point like a four-dimensional balloon being inflated, creating in every instant more space in the universe. Sometime after the expansion begins, galaxies condense and are carried outward on the surface of the hypersphere. There are astronomers in each galaxy, and the light they see is also trapped on the curved surface of the hypersphere. As the sphere expands, an astronomer in any galaxy will think all the other galaxies are running away from him. There are no privileged reference frames. The farther away the galaxy, the faster its recession. The galaxies are embedded in, attached to, space, and the fabric of space is expanding. And to the question, where in the present universe did the Big Bang occur? The answer is clearly everywhere. If there's insufficient matter to prevent the universe from expanding forever, it must have an open shape, curved, like a saddle, with a surface extending to infinity in our three-dimensional analogy. If there is enough matter, then it has a closed shape, curved like a sphere in our three-dimensional analogy. If the universe is closed, light is trapped within it. In the 1920s, in a direction opposite to M31, observers found a distant pair of spiral galaxies. Was it possible, they wondered, that they were seeing the Milky Way and M31 from the other direction, like seeing the back of your head with light that has circumnavigated the universe? We now know that the universe is much larger than they imagined in the 1920s. It would take more than the age of the universe for light to circumnavigate it. And the galaxies are younger than the universe. But if the cosmos is closed and light cannot escape from it, then it may be perfectly correct to describe the universe as a black hole. If you wish to know what it is like inside a black hole, look around you. We have previously mentioned the possibility of wormholes to get from one place in the universe to another without covering the intervening distance through a black hole. We can imagine these wormholes as tubes running through a fourth physical dimension. We do not know that such wormholes exist, but if they do, must they always hook up with another place in our universe? Or is it just possible that wormholes connect with other universes, places that would otherwise be forever inaccessible to us? For all we know, there may be many other universes. Perhaps they are, in some sense, nested within one another. There is an idea, strange, haunting, evocative, one of the most exquisite conjectures in science or religion. It is entirely undemonstrated. It may never be proved, but it stirs the blood. There is, we are told, an infinite hierarchy of universes, so that an elementary particle, such as an electron in our universe, would, if penetrated, reveal itself to be an entire closed universe. Within it, organized into the local equivalent of galaxies and smaller structures, are an immense number of other, much tinier elementary particles, which are themselves universes at the next level, and so on forever. An infinite downward regression, universes within universes endlessly, and upward as well. Our familiar universe of galaxies and stars, planets and people would be a single elementary particle in the next universe up, the first step of another infinite regress. This is the only religious idea I know that surpasses the endless number of infinitely old cycling universes in Hindu cosmology. What would those other universes be like? Would they be built on different laws of physics? Would they have stars and galaxies and worlds, or something quite different? Might they be compatible with some unimaginably different form of life? To enter them, we would somehow have to penetrate a fourth physical dimension. Not an easy undertaking, surely, but perhaps a black hole would provide a way. There may be small black holes in the solar neighborhood, poised at the edge of forever. We would jump off. Chapter 11, The Persistence of Memory. Now that the destinies of heaven and earth have been fixed, trench and canal have been given their proper course, the banks of the Tigris and the Euphrates have been established, what else shall we do? What else shall we create? O Anunnaki, you great gods of the sky, what else shall we do? The Assyrian account of the creation of man, 800 BC. When he, whoever of the gods it was, had thus arranged in order and resolved that chaotic mass and reduced it, thus resolved to cosmic parts, he first molded the earth into the form of a mighty ball, so that it might be of like form on every side, and that no region might be without its own forms of animate life. The stars and divine forms occupied the floor of heaven. The sea fell to the shining fishes for their home. Earth received the beasts and the mobile air, the birds. Then man was born. Though all other animals are prone and fix their gaze upon the earth, he gave to man an uplifted face and bade him stand erect and turn his eyes to heaven. Ovid, Metamorphoses, 1st century. In the great cosmic dark, there are countless stars and planets both younger and older than our solar system. Although we cannot yet be certain, the same processes that led on Earth to the evolution of life and intelligence should have been operating throughout the cosmos. There may be a million worlds in the Milky Way galaxy alone that at this moment are inhabited by beings who are very different from us and far more advanced. Knowing a great deal is not the same as being smart. Intelligence is not information alone, but also judgment, the manner in which information is coordinated and used. Still, the amount of information to which we have access is one index of our intelligence. The measuring rod, the unit of information, is something called a bit, for binary digit. It is an answer, either yes or no, to an unambiguous question. To specify whether a lamp is on or off requires a single bit of information. To designate one letter out of the 26 in the Latin alphabet takes 5 bits. 2^5 = 2 × 2 × 2 × 2 × 2 × 2, which equals 32, which is more than 26. The verbal information content of this book is a little less than 10 million bits, 10^7. The total number of bits that characterizes an hour-long television program is about 10^12. The information in the words and pictures of different books in all the libraries on Earth is something like 10^16, or 10^17 bits. Of course, much of it is redundant. Such a number calibrates crudely what humans know, but elsewhere, on older worlds, where life has evolved billions of years earlier than on Earth, perhaps they know 10^20 bits, or 10^30, not just more information, but significantly different information. Of those million worlds inhabited by advanced intelligences, consider a rare planet, the only one in its system with a surface ocean of liquid water. In this rich aquatic environment, many relatively intelligent creatures live, some with 8 appendages for grasping, others that communicate among themselves by changing an intricate pattern of bright and dark mottling on their bodies. Even clever little creatures from the land who make brief forays into the ocean in vessels of wood or metal. But we seek the dominant intelligences, the grandest creatures on the planet, the sentient and graceful masters of the deep ocean, the great whales. They are the largest animals ever to evolve on the planet Earth, larger by far than the dinosaurs. An adult blue whale can be 30 meters long and weigh 150 tons. Many, especially the baleen whales, are placid browsers straining through vast volumes of ocean for the small animals on which they graze. Others eat fish and krill. The whales are recent arrivals in the ocean. Only 70 million years ago, their ancestors were carnivorous mammals who migrated in slow steps from the land into the ocean. Among the whales, mothers suckle and care tenderly for their offspring. There is a long childhood in which the adults teach the young. Play is a typical pastime. These are all mammalian characteristics, all important for the development of intelligent beings. The sea is murky. Sight and smell, which work well for mammals on the land, are not of much use in the depths of the ocean. Those ancestors of the whales who relied on these senses to locate a mate or a baby or a predator did not leave many offspring. So another method was perfected by evolution. It works superbly well and is central to any understanding of the whales: the sense of sound. Some whale sounds are called songs, but we are still ignorant of their true nature and meaning. They range over a broad band of frequencies, down to well below the lowest sound the human ear can detect. A typical whale song lasts for perhaps 15 minutes, the longest, about an hour. Often, it is repeated, identically, beat for beat, measure for measure, note for note. Occasionally, a group of whales will leave their winter waters in the midst of a song, and 6 months later, return to continue at precisely the right note as if there had been no interruption. Whales are very good at remembering. More often, on their return, the vocalizations have changed. New songs appear on the cetacean hit parade. Very often, the members of the group will sing the same song together. By some mutual consensus, some collaborative songwriting, the piece changes month by month, slowly and predictably. These vocalizations are complex. If the songs of the humpback whale are enunciated as a tonal language, the total information content, the number of bits of information in such songs, is some 10 to the 6th power bits, about the same as the information content of the Iliad or the Odyssey. We do not know what whales or their cousins, the dolphins, have to talk or sing about. They have no manipulative organs. They make no engineering constructs, but they are social creatures. They hunt, swim, fish, browse, frolic, mate, play, run from predators. There may be a great deal to talk about. The primary danger to the whales is a newcomer, an upstart animal, only recently through technology become competent in the oceans, a creature that calls itself human. For 99.99% of the history of whales, there were no humans in or on the deep oceans. During this period, the whales evolved their extraordinary audio communication system. The finbacks, for example, emit extremely loud sounds at a frequency of 20 hertz, down near the lowest octave on the piano keyboard. A hertz is a unit of sound frequency that represents one sound wave, one crest, and one trough, entering your ear every second. Such low-frequency sounds are scarcely absorbed in the ocean. The American biologist Roger Payne has calculated that using the deep ocean sound channel, two whales could communicate with each other at 20 hertz essentially anywhere in the world. One might be off the Ross Ice Shelf in Antarctica and communicate with another in the Aleutians. For most of their history, whales may have established a global communications network. Perhaps when separated by 15,000 kilometers, their vocalizations are love songs cast, hopefully, into the vastness of the deep. For tens of millions of years, these enormous, intelligent, communicative creatures evolved with essentially no natural enemies. Then, the development of the steamship in the 19th century introduced an ominous source of noise pollution. As commercial and military vessels became more abundant, the noise background in the oceans, especially at a frequency of 20 hertz, became noticeable. Whales communicating across the oceans must have experienced increasingly greater difficulties. The distance over which they could communicate must have decreased steadily. 200 years ago, a typical distance across which finbacks could communicate was perhaps 10,000 kilometers. Today, the corresponding number is perhaps a few hundred kilometers. Do whales know each other's names? Can they recognize each other as individuals by sounds alone? We have cut the whales off from themselves. Creatures that communicated for tens of millions of years have now effectively been silenced. There is a curious counterpoint to this story. The preferred radio channel for interstellar communication with other technical civilizations is near a frequency of 1.42 billion hertz, marked by a radio spectral line of hydrogen, the most abundant atom in the universe. We are just beginning to listen here for signals of intelligent origin. But the frequency band is being increasingly encroached upon by civilian and military communications traffic on Earth, and not only by the major powers. We are jamming the interstellar channel. Uncontrolled growth of terrestrial radio technology may prevent us from ready communication with intelligent beings on distant worlds. Their songs may go unanswered because we have not the will to control our radio frequency pollution and listen. And we have done worse than that, because there persists to this day a traffic in the dead bodies of whales. There are humans who hunt and slaughter whales and market the products for lipstick or industrial lubricant. Many nations understand that the systematic murder of such intelligent creatures is monstrous, but the traffic continues, promoted chiefly by Japan, Norway, and the Soviet Union. We humans, as a species, are interested in communication with extraterrestrial intelligence. Would not a good beginning be improved communication with terrestrial intelligence, with other human beings of different cultures and languages, with the great apes, with the dolphins, but particularly with those intelligent masters of the deep, the great whales? For a whale to live, there are many things it must know how to do. This knowledge is stored in its genes and in its brains. The genetic information includes how to convert plankton into blubber, or how to hold your breath on a dive 1 kilometer below the surface. The information in the brains, the learned information, includes such things as who your mother is, or the meaning of the song you are hearing just now. The whale, like all other animals on the earth, has a gene library and a brain library. The genetic material of the whale, like the genetic material of human beings, is made of nucleic acids, those extraordinary molecules capable of reproducing themselves from the chemical building blocks that surround them, and of turning hereditary information into action. For example, one whale enzyme identical to one you have in every cell of your body is called hexokinase, the first of more than 24 enzyme-mediated steps required to convert a molecule of sugar obtained from the plankton in the whale's diet into a little energy, perhaps a contribution to a single low-frequency note in the music of the whale. The information stored in the DNA double helix of a whale or a human or any other beast or vegetable on Earth is written in a language of 4 letters. The 4 different kinds of nucleotides, the molecular components that make up DNA. How many bits of information are contained in the hereditary material of various life forms? How many yes-no answers to the various biological questions are written in the language of life. A virus needs about 10,000 bits, roughly equivalent to the amount of information on this page, but the viral information is simple, exceedingly compact, extraordinarily efficient. Reading it requires very close attention. These are the instructions it needs to infect some other organism and to reproduce itself, the only things that viruses are any good at. A bacterium uses roughly 1 million bits of information, which is about 100 printed pages. Bacteria have a lot more to do than viruses. Unlike the viruses, they are not thoroughgoing parasites. Bacteria have to make a living. And a free-swimming, one-celled amoeba is much more sophisticated, with about 400 million bits in its DNA. It would require some 8,500-page volumes to make another amoeba. A whale, or a human being, needs something like 5 billion bits. The 5 times 10 to the 9th power bits of information in our encyclopedia of life, in the nucleus of each of our cells, if written out in, say, English, would fill 1,000 volumes. Every one of your 100 trillion cells contains a complete library of instructions on how to make every part of you. Every cell in your body arises by successive cell divisions from a single cell, a fertilized egg generated by your parents. Every time that cell divided, in the many embryological steps that went into making you, the original set of genetic instructions was duplicated with great fidelity. So, your liver cells have some unemployed knowledge about how to make your bone cells, and vice versa. The genetic library contains everything your body knows how to do on its own. The ancient information is written in exhaustive, careful, redundant detail. How to laugh, how to sneeze, how to walk, how to recognize patterns, how to reproduce, how to digest an apple. Eating an apple is an immensely complicated process. In fact, if I had to synthesize my own enzymes, if I consciously had to remember and direct all the chemical steps required to get energy out of food, I would probably starve. But even bacteria do anaerobic glycolysis, which is why apples rot. Lunchtime for the microbes. They, and we, and all creatures in between possess many similar genetic instructions. Our separate gene libraries have many pages in common, another reminder of our common evolutionary heritage. Our technology can duplicate only a tiny fraction of the intricate biochemistry that our bodies effortlessly perform. We have only just begun to study these processes. Evolution, however, has had billions of years of practice. DNA knows. But suppose what you had to do was so complicated that even several billion bits was insufficient. Suppose the environment was changing so fast that the pre-coded genetic encyclopedia, which served perfectly well before, was no longer entirely adequate. Then, even a gene library of 1,000 volumes would not be enough. That is why we have brains. Like all our organs, the brain has evolved, increasing in complexity and information content over millions of years. Its structure reflects all the stages through which it has passed. The brain evolved from the inside out. Deep inside is the oldest part, the brain stem, which conducts the basic biological functions, including the rhythms of life, heartbeat, and respiration. According to a provocative insight by Paul MacLean, the higher functions of the brain evolved in 3 successive stages. Capping the brain stem is the R complex, the seat of aggression, ritual, territoriality, and social hierarchy, which evolved hundreds of millions of years ago in our reptilian ancestors. Deep inside the skull of every one of us, there is something like the brain of a crocodile. Surrounding the R complex is the limbic system, or mammalian brain, which evolved tens of millions of years ago in ancestors who were mammals but not yet primates. It is a major source of our moods and emotions, of our concern and care for the young. And finally, on the outside, living in uneasy truce with the more primitive brains beneath is the cerebral cortex, which evolved millions of years ago in our primate ancestors. The cerebral cortex, where matter is transformed into consciousness, is the point of embarkation for all our cosmic voyages. Comprising more than two-thirds of the brain mass, it is the realm of both intuition and critical analysis. It is here that we have ideas and inspirations, here that we read and write, here that we do mathematics and compose music. The cortex regulates our conscious lives. It is the distinction of our species, the seat of our humanity. Civilization is a product of the cerebral cortex. The language of the brain is not the DNA language of the genes. Rather, what we know is encoded in cells called neurons, microscopic electrochemical switching elements, typically a few hundredths of a millimeter across. Each of us has perhaps 100 billion neurons, comparable to the number of stars in the Milky Way galaxy. Many neurons have thousands of connections with their neighbors. There are something like 100 trillion, 10 to the 14th power, such connections in the human cerebral cortex. Charles Sherrington imagined the activities in the cerebral cortex upon awakening. The cortex becomes now a sparkling field of rhythmic flashing points, with trains of traveling sparks hurrying hither and thither. The brain is waking, and with it the mind is returning. It is as if the Milky Way entered upon some cosmic dance. Swiftly, the cortex becomes an enchanted loom where millions of flashing shuttles weave a dissolving pattern, always a meaningful pattern, though never an abiding one, a shifting harmony of sub-patterns. Now, as the waking body rouses, sub-patterns of this great harmony of activity stretch down into the unlit tracks of the lower brain. Strings of flashing and traveling sparks engage the links of it. This means that the body is up and rises to meet its waking day. Even in sleep, the brain is pulsing, throbbing and flashing with the complex business of human life, dreaming, remembering, figuring things out. Our thoughts, visions, and fantasies have a physical reality. A thought is made of hundreds of electrochemical impulses. If we were shrunk to the level of the neurons, we might witness elaborate, intricate, evanescent patterns. One might be the spark of a memory of the smell of lilacs on a country road in childhood. Another might be part of an anxious all-points bulletin. Where did I leave the keys? There are many valleys in the mountains of the mind, convolutions that greatly increase the surface area available in the cerebral cortex for information storage in a skull of limited size. The neurochemistry of the brain is astonishingly busy, the circuitry of a machine more wonderful than any devised by humans. But there is no evidence that its functioning is due to anything more than the 10 to the 14th power neural connections that build an elegant architecture of consciousness. The world of thought is divided roughly into two hemispheres. The right hemisphere of the cerebral cortex is mainly responsible for pattern recognition, intuition, sensitivity, creative insights. The left hemisphere presides over rational, analytical, and critical thinking. These are the dual strengths, the essential opposites that characterize human thinking. Together, they provide the means both for generating ideas and for testing their validity. A continuous dialogue is going on between the two hemispheres, channeled through an immense bundle of nerves, the corpus callosum, the bridge between creativity and analysis, both of which are necessary to understand the world. The information content of the human brain expressed in bits is probably comparable to the total number of connections among the neurons, about 100 trillion, 10 to the 14th power bits. If written out in English, say, that information would fill some 20 million volumes, as many as in the world's largest libraries. The equivalent of 20 million books is inside the heads of every one of us. The brain is a very big place in a very small space. Most of the books in the brain are in the cerebral cortex. Down in the basement are the functions our remote ancestors mainly depended on. Aggression, child-rearing, fear, sex, the willingness to follow leaders blindly. Of the higher brain functions, some, reading, writing, speaking, seem to be localized in particular places in the cerebral cortex. Memories, on the other hand, are stored redundantly in many locales. If such a thing as telepathy existed, one of its glories would be the opportunity for each of us to read the books in the cerebral cortices of our loved ones. But there is no compelling evidence for telepathy, and the communication of such information remains the task of artists and writers. The brain does much more than recollect. It compares, synthesizes, analyzes, generates abstractions. We must figure out much more than our genes can know. That is why the brain library is some 10,000 times larger than the gene library. Our passion for learning, evident in the behavior of every toddler, is the tool for our survival. Emotions and ritualized behavior patterns are built deeply into us. They are part of our humanity, but they are not characteristically human. Many other animals have feelings. What distinguishes our species is thought. The cerebral cortex is a liberation. We need no longer be trapped in the genetically inherited behavior patterns of lizards and baboons. We are, each of us, largely responsible for what gets put into our brains, for what, as adults, we wind up caring for and knowing about. No longer at the mercy of the reptile brain, we can change ourselves. Most of the world's great cities have grown haphazardly, little by little, in response to the needs of the moment. Very rarely is a city planned for the remote future. The evolution of a city is like the evolution of the brain. It develops from a small center and slowly grows and changes, leaving many old parts still functioning. There is no way for evolution to rip out the ancient interior of the brain because of its imperfections and replace it with something of a more modern manufacture. The brain must function during the renovation. That is why our brainstem is surrounded by the R complex, then the limbic system, and finally the cerebral cortex. The old parts are in charge of too many fundamental functions for them to be replaced altogether. So they wheeze along, out of date and sometimes counterproductive, but a necessary consequence of our evolution. In New York City, the arrangement of many of the major streets dates back to the 17th century, the stock exchange to the 18th century, the waterworks to the 19th, the electrical power system to the 20th. The arrangement might be more efficient if all civic systems were constructed in parallel and replaced periodically, which is why disastrous fires, the great conflagrations of London and Chicago, for example, are sometimes an aid in city planning. But the slow accretion of new functions permits the city to work more or less continuously through the centuries. In the 17th century, you traveled between Brooklyn and Manhattan across the East River by ferry. In the 19th century, the technology became available to construct a suspension bridge across the river. It was built precisely at the site of the ferry terminal, both because the city owned the land and because major thoroughfares were already converging on the pre-existing ferry service. Later, when it was possible to construct a tunnel under the river, it too was built in the same place for the same reasons, and also because small abandoned precursors of tunnels called caissons had already been emplaced during the construction of the bridge. This use and restructuring of previous systems for new purposes is very much like the pattern of biological evolution. When our genes could not store all the information necessary for survival, we slowly invented them. But then the time came, perhaps 10,000 years ago, when we needed to know more than could conveniently be contained in brains. So we learned to stockpile enormous quantities of information outside our bodies. We are the only species on the planet, so far as we know, to have invented a communal memory stored neither in our genes nor in our brains. The warehouse of that memory is called the library. A book is made from a tree. It is an assemblage of flat, flexible parts, still called leaves, imprinted with dark, pigmented squiggles. One glance at it, and you hear the voice of another person, perhaps someone dead for thousands of years. Across the millennia, the author is speaking clearly and silently inside your head, directly to you. Writing is perhaps the greatest of human inventions, binding together people, citizens of distant epochs who never knew one another. Books break the shackles of time, proof that humans can work magic. Some of the earliest authors wrote on clay. Cuneiform writing, the remote ancestor of the Western alphabet, was invented in the Near East about 5,000 years ago. Its purpose was to keep records, the purchase of grain, the sale of land, the triumphs of the king, the statutes of the priests, the positions of the stars, the prayers to the gods. For thousands of years, writing was chiseled into clay and stone, scratched onto wax or bark or leather, painted on bamboo or papyrus or silk, but always one copy at a time and, except for the inscriptions on monuments, always for a tiny readership. Then in China, between the 2nd and 6th centuries, paper, ink, and printing with carved wooden blocks were all invented, permitting many copies of a work to be made and distributed. It took 1,000 years for the idea to catch on in remote and backward Europe. Then, suddenly, books were being printed all over the world. Just before the invention of movable type around 1450, there were no more than a few tens of thousands of books in all of Europe, all handwritten, about as many as in China in 100 BC, and a tenth as many as in the Great Library of Alexandria. 50 years later, around 1500, there were 10 million printed books. Learning had become available to anyone who could read. Magic was everywhere. More recently, books, especially paperbacks, have been printed in massive and inexpensive editions. For the price of a modest meal, you can ponder the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, the origin of species, the interpretation of dreams, the nature of things. Books are like seeds. They can lie dormant for centuries and then flower in the most unpromising soil. The great libraries of the world contain millions of volumes, the equivalent of about 10 to the 14th power bits of information in words and perhaps 10 to the 15th power bits in pictures. This is 10,000 times more information than in our genes, and about 10 times more than in our brains. If I finish a book a week, I will read only a few thousand books in my lifetime, about 0.1% of the contents of the greatest libraries of our time. The trick is to know which books to read. The information in books is not pre-programmed at birth, but constantly changed, amended by events, adapted to the world. It is now 23 centuries since the founding of the Alexandrian Library. If there were no books, no written records, think how prodigious a time 23 centuries would be. With 4 generations per century, 23 centuries occupies almost 100 generations of human beings. If information could be passed on merely by word of mouth, how little we should know of our past, how slow would be our progress. Everything would depend on what ancient findings we had accidentally been told about and how accurate the account was. Past information might be revered, but in successive retellings, it would become progressively more muddled and eventually lost. Books permit us to voyage through time, to tap the wisdom of our ancestors. The library connects us with the insights and knowledge painfully extracted from nature of the greatest minds that ever were, with the best teachers drawn from the entire planet and from all of our history to instruct us without tiring and to inspire us to make our own contribution to the collective knowledge of the human species. Public libraries depend on voluntary contributions. I think the health of our civilization, the depth of our awareness about the underpinnings of our culture and our concern for the future can all be tested by how well we support our libraries. Were the Earth to be started all over again, with all its physical features identical, it is extremely unlikely that anything closely resembling a human being would ever again emerge. There is a powerful random character to the evolutionary process. A cosmic ray striking a different gene, producing a different mutation, can have small consequences early, but profound consequences late. Happenstance may play a powerful role in biology as it does in history. The farther back the critical events occur, the more powerfully can they influence the present. For example, consider our hands. We have five fingers, including one opposable thumb. They serve us quite well, but I think we would be served equally well with six fingers, including a thumb, or four fingers, including a thumb, or maybe five fingers and two thumbs. There is nothing intrinsically best about our particular configuration of fingers, which we ordinarily think of as so natural and inevitable. We have five fingers because we have descended from a Devonian fish that had five phalanges or bones in its fins. Had we descended from a fish with four or six phalanges, we would have four or six fingers on each hand and would think them perfectly natural. We use base 10 arithmetic only because we have 10 fingers on our hands. Had the arrangement been otherwise, we would use base 8 or base 12 arithmetic and relegate base 10 to the new math. The same point applies, I believe, to many more essential aspects of our being: our hereditary material, our internal biochemistry, our form, stature, organ systems, loves and hates, passions and despairs, tenderness and aggression, even our analytical processes. All of these are at least in part the result of apparently minor accidents in our immensely long evolutionary history. Perhaps if one less dragonfly had drowned in the carboniferous swamps, the intelligent organisms on our planet today would have feathers and teach their young in rookeries. The pattern of evolutionary causality is a web of astonishing complexity. The incompleteness of our understanding humbles us. Just 65 million years ago, our ancestors were the most unprepossessing of mammals, creatures with the size and intelligence of moles or tree shrews. It would have taken a very audacious biologist to guess that such animals would eventually produce the line that dominates the Earth today. The Earth, then, was full of awesome, nightmarish lizards, the dinosaurs, immensely successful creatures which filled virtually every ecological niche. There were swimming reptiles, flying reptiles, and reptiles, some as tall as a six-story building, thundering across the face of the Earth. Some of them had rather large brains, an upright posture, and two little front legs, very much like hands, which they used to catch small, speedy mammals, probably including our distant ancestors, for dinner. If such dinosaurs had survived, perhaps the dominant intelligent species on our planet today would be 4 meters tall with green skin and sharp teeth, and the human form would be considered a lurid fantasy of Saurian science fiction. But the dinosaurs did not survive. In one catastrophic event, all of them, and many, perhaps most of the other species on the Earth, were destroyed. But not the tree shrews, not the mammals. They survived. No one knows what wiped out the dinosaurs. One evocative idea is that it was a cosmic catastrophe, the explosion of a nearby star, a supernova, like the one that produced the Crab Nebula. If there were by chance a supernova within 10 or 20 light years of the solar system some 65 million years ago, it would have sprayed an intense flux of cosmic rays into space, and some of these, entering the Earth's envelope of air, would have burned the atmospheric nitrogen. The oxides of nitrogen thus generated would have removed the protective layer of ozone from the atmosphere, increasing the flux of solar ultraviolet radiation at the surface and frying and mutating the many organisms imperfectly protected against intense ultraviolet light. Some of those organisms may have been staples of the dinosaurs.